Hi everyone, thank you very much for joining our session. Today is Wednesday and it's a perfect day for discussing some stablecoin use and risk. So this is going to be a 55 minute session, 45 minutes for panel discussion, and then the last 10 minutes is going to be for Q&A. The Q&A is only open to audience at the venue, and I believe you need to scan the QR code here to submit your question. So let's get started. I'm Tammy. I'm specialized in on-chain research, and then I'm passionate about stablecoin and stablecoin risk. So I have spent some time on developing a stablecoin risk assessment framework that leverage data-driven metrics. And today I am the moderator of the session. Really excited about our panel with representatives coming from stablecoin project and on-chain liquidity provider. How about we start the session from you guys introduce a little bit about yourself?
Hi everyone. Alessandro, I'm the CTO at Dialectic. We are a on-chain liquidity provider. You can think about us as like institutional grade yield farming. So we provide liquidity to anything that is on chain and is paying incentives. So it's kind of liquidity as a service as well. And we deploy into stablecoins and ETH and Bitcoin yield opportunities, mainly on EVM chains. And I'll probably be talking mainly about risk today.
My name is Colin. I'm the head of product for Liquidy. We are the most decentralized immutable stablecoin that exists with LUSD. And I'm in charge of an upcoming product called Liquidy V2. And we'll have a stablecoin called Bold. So we'll help you with the yield part of this question.
And I'm Mariah. I'm a co-founder of Gyroscope. I also did one of the probably first PhDs looking at DeFi. Back in about like 2018, 2019. And Gyroscope is a combination of a decentralized stablecoin and a DEX, so it's a little unique in that regard. It's a protocol that's focused on risk and liquidity management, as well as kind of generating new yield opportunities around specifically decentralized stablecoins.
Well, for the last 12 months, we have seen the number of new stablecoin projects rise exponentially. However, I think around 94% of the stablecoin market share are dominated by four top stablecoin projects on Ethereum. So 58% by USDT, 27% by USDC, around 5.6% by DAI and the rebranded version USDS, and then around 3% by USDE, which is just launched last year. So at this point, it seems like the main way for new stablecoin project to compete is on yield opportunities. So my first question will be, at this point in the market, what yield strategy do new stablecoin use to compete, and how do you see this evolve over time?
Yeah, so I think it's a really good point. So yield is a big aspect. So our current LUSD, we don't compete on yield. Our yield right now is not great. It's 2 or 3%, where most other places are paying much more. We're building a new product, should be no surprise there. It's not the whole story. I mean, there are different risks that come in, the other half of the yield. So Athena is kind of mentioned with USDE as being one of the higher yielding stablecoins. But a lot of people are concerned about the risks. One of the highest yielding stablecoins in the last cycle, of course, was UST. Which no longer exists. So you can kind of see, and I'm not proposing that Athena is going to go down that route at any stretch of the imagination, but there are people that worry about, well, why am I getting paid more? Because in finance, risk and reward kind of go hand in hand, and if you find a way outside of that, you're either losing or you're winning, but most people kind of get it in the middle. But I think you hit on a really interesting point, which is how do you product segment using yield and using your risk profile. And I think what's really interesting is if you look in the TradFi sector, or we're just kind of across other DeFi things, everything we label as a stablecoin, I mean, it's a transferable unit of account that's generally measured in dollars. I mean, it could be another currency. But your savings account at a bank is as well, as is your investment in a treasuries. These are all based on dollars or in baht, we're in Thailand, or euros or whatever. But they do different things, and some of them may require you to lock money up for a certain time. And for different parts of your portfolio, that makes sense. And I think with stablecoins, we're going to see niche use cases. USDC, USDT work really well because they're in centralized exchanges. They're very good at on-ramping and off-ramping. They don't provide yield. Athena is the polar opposite. So I think that we're going to see lots of segmentation around that, focusing on yield as well as liquidity and other aspects.
And
yeah, I would add a little bit on top of that. In particular, for like new entrants to the stablecoin space, there is kind of like a spectrum, of course, between like how much risk are you taking on with this stablecoin design, and also like how much you have to be compensated for that risk. But at the same time, you also have to compete with the like existing incumbents, mainly like USDC and USDT, who have very entrenched liquidity, and the usefulness of your stablecoin really depends a fair amount on how easy it is to get in and out of your stablecoin to actually use it for what you're intending to use. And that depends on like how liquid your stablecoin can actually be. And it's kind of like a chicken or the egg problem. Even if you're not like intending to only be focused on yield, you somehow have to like establish your liquidity, and usually you have to pay for it and like compete with the cost of capital of other stablecoins, which actually is like an advantage of USDC and USDT for them. Like, they don't have to pay for it.
Yeah, and that maybe also just like the fact that like most of the stablecoin liquidity is actually not in DeFi. I think like all of us here on the panel at least are like very much focused on the DeFi use case. But most of the supply of stablecoins is outside of DeFi and is used in centralized exchanges, is used for payments. And there the existing network effects, I think, are very difficult for especially like DeFi focused stablecoins to compete with on those use cases. So where the DeFi stablecoins are really competing at is in the DeFi ecosystem, where it's more about using the stablecoins as collateral, it's using the stablecoins as pairs with other stablecoins, and there the yield component becomes a lot more important. And it's the one of the big ways in which the different coins try to get their own share of the market. Now, as Colin very correctly said, it's really much about risk-adjusted yield. And for us as like large-scale liquidity providers, that's ultimately what we care about. If we can get very high APR in a position that's very risky, then that's not something that we may do, or we may only do with a very small part of the portfolio. And then most of that liquidity goes to like lower yield, but also much lower risk stablecoins.
So what is the yield strategy at Gyroscope and liquidity then? Can you give us some details on that? I know you mentioned that, but like traditionally, a stablecoin user can earn yields from providing liquidity, and now you have a yield-bearing stablecoin, which is liquidity V2, and Gyroscope has their SGYD as well. Can you give us some more details on that?
Yeah, I can fill in a bit about Gyroscope there. So realistically, a lot of the kind of early go-to-market for a new stablecoin does end up focusing around yield, just for this like chicken or the egg problem of you have to establish enough liquidity that your product is actually useful. And then also, like realistically also, a lot of just stablecoins get used in DeFi and then like become ingrained in various yield strategies. And so the actual usage of stuff, at least on-chain, ends up revolving quite a lot around yield. For Gyroscope in particular, we have, I mentioned we have kind of like a unique combination of a stablecoin that's decentralized and a decentralized exchange. We have two main kind of like yield products that are part of the go-to-market, I suppose. One is a yield-bearing version of the stablecoin, SGYD, for compared to the stablecoin that's non-yielding, GYD. And what SGYD does is kind of similar to some other yield-bearing stablecoins. It takes the revenues that come in from kind of various aspects of how the protocol works and forwards them back to users who opt to hold SGYD instead of using GYD somewhere else. And currently, that yield kind of averages kind of between like 12 and 16% right now in the current environment. And then we also have our decentralized exchange. We have what we consider a more efficient liquidity pool type that's also more easy for kind of like LPs to use. It's focused on what's called asymmetric concentrated liquidity. You can think of it, it's kind of a big word, but you can think of it as just a way to squeeze more liquidity out of the same assets that you're putting into the pool by kind of strategically choosing which parts of the pricing region you actually need. And tying that in also with like how this stablecoin is actually designed. So why we built it actually for GYD is that GYD has like a minting and redemption function, and we use that to basically say, hey, minting and redeeming kind of takes care of most of the pricing range. And you can then make kind of secondary markets focused on very particular areas. And so that's like a high level idea of why our decentralized exchange is kind of more efficient. It's made specifically for GYD, like that was one of the reasons why we built it. And so one of the most efficient places to actually put GYD to use is using it in our decentralized exchange, which also like ends up routing quite a lot of volume these days too.
Yeah, so I think you made some really good points in there. Kind of one of the things, like when we designed our product, the realization and kind of taking a step back with our first version is, there's actually unlimited demand to create stablecoins. I mean, I think if I did a survey here and I said, if you could mint a token that was worth a dollar, would you do it? And I think everybody would say, I'll do that in unlimited size. The issue is there's not unlimited demand to hold your token that you just minted. We realized that actually with V1, because when you would mint it, you'd pay a 0.5% fee, and that was it for the rest of your life. We had some mechanisms in there, which ultimately kind of created an issue. With our V2, we kind of understood that everybody would mint on an unlimited amount, but you have to pay this borrowing rate. So we've been talking about yield. Our kind of USP is that you set the rate you want to pay. You decide what interest rate you want to pay for that stablecoin you've minted. Now, this guy might choose 3% a year, you might choose 8. Why would you choose 3 and you 8? We have a mechanism called redemption, and essentially we are a CDP, which means you put in ETH or LSTs, you paying 3, if that somebody can acquire that for less than a dollar, they can turn around, take that stablecoin, and take your ETH. Obviously, you probably like ETH. I imagine most people at DevCon probably are constructive on the price. Depends on the talks you went to go see before this. But if you believe it's going to go up over time, you don't want to lose that and have somebody pay back your debt. So you might say, okay, well, I'm getting 3%, that's a great deal now, but if I see that I'm likely to be redeemed, I'm gonna move that up and pay closer to 8% like this person over here. Over time, what that should yield is kind of a very good rate that is a decentralized reference rate, is what we refer to it as. In TradFi, we have these reference rates. It's how much does it cost to borrow a dollar? If DeFi, we ask that same question, we'll get like 18 different answers. People might reference TradFi, they might reference Aave, they might reference Maker, but there's no one number. Our goal is to hopefully get enough liquidity to be part of that answer, and in time we hope to be that answer over a medium to long-term timeframe.
Oh, well, since you both, we mentioned the yield-bearing stablecoin, which is, it does not only offer the stable value, but also it gains yields based on return on underlying collateral. And then it seems like for the last 12 months, real world asset become a really popular choices. What's your view on this? What's your view on this mass adoption of real world asset, the pros and cons? Maybe Colin will be the last one to answer that. I know you have a lot of opinion.
I mean, I work in DeFi. So real world assets don't exist in my world because they're not DeFi. It's great if people want to play with them. Go to Goldman Sachs and do that.
That's it. What's your opinion then, Alessandro?
I mean, like, it's for us, it's a very different set of risks where we are very specialized in understanding and measuring and mitigating risks of on-chain things that are transparent, that we can audit, that we can go deep and understand, like, fundamentally how these mechanisms work. We have full on-chain auditability of what the reserves are. So for us, that's what we focus on, and it's very not easy, but it's very intuitive for us to think about risk that way. As soon as the assets leave the chains, the set of risks that you take on are very different. You need to look at counterparties and jurisdictions and understand what the rights are in case of bankruptcy of the custodian. And it just adds like another dimension to the stablecoin game. And I feel like over time, the decentralized options should mirror the yields that the RWA take, if not more. And also like the RWA yield on T-bills, which I guess is the most common asset to back stablecoins with these days, is going down. And depending on how the economy goes in the next year or so, it's expected to go down even further. So I think that the RWA push was really due because the yields were very high, and then it makes sense for DeFi to tap into these yields. But as they go down, I believe the decentralized options that are crypto native, that are built on DeFi primitives, will outcompete not just on the yields, but also in terms of transparency and auditability, and therefore in terms of risk as well.
So I would put real world assets in kind of a similar boat to like USDC. So you can do a lot of DeFi stuff with USDC and RWAs, but that doesn't mean that like a centralized stablecoin or like an RWA is like itself DeFi. You can use it and you can do interesting stuff on top of it. But yeah, I mean, I'm pretty sympathetic to what you were saying, Colin, about like, I think something that's like vastly underappreciated is just how much risk there actually is in RWAs, even to the point where like if your goal is to hold like an RWA, it doesn't really make sense for you to hold it like directly in DeFi. You're choosing like an inherently riskier way of holding this asset. So it really only makes sense if like it's useful for something else you want to do in DeFi, kind of like building on top of it.
And also, what I feel like is sometimes when people talk about tokenized real-world assets, right, they always mention about the transparency, but it's not necessarily always true. And then for tokenized credit pool, if they went bust, the process to recover the asset underlying, it's actually quite difficult to understand, especially for general user. We know the market is driven by yield, and most of the users are motivated by yield. Not all of us want to talk about the risk. I once asked a friend about how he chose a stablecoin, and then he told me that he feels pretty comfortable if the yield is high and if the market cap is above $100 million. That sounds like someone is going to lose their money during the Terra crash. So I think what we need to know is stablecoin users face different type of risk depending on how they engage with stablecoin, whether it's direct holder, whether it's a leverage user, lender, or whether it's liquidity provider. So one of the most discussed risks is the stablecoin depegging risk, where the stablecoin price is significantly lower than the peg value or the value they try to stabilize. So in your view, what factor may cause the stablecoin to become insolvent or permanently lost part of its value?
I mean, there's like many reasons why stablecoins depeg. In theory, if a token is redeemable one-to-one against an asset that has a fixed value and has a lot of liquidity and you can like exit the position some way, it shouldn't. Now, there's many things that go back. And it goes from like smart contracts getting exploited and people minting more stable coins than what the collateral is, and then it defects for that reason, or it is because Silicon Valley Bank is going bankrupt and then USDC defects because the reserves are not on chain and people can't verify how much money is actually exposed. And then in the past, we've seen like algorithmic stable coins and people have been trying a lot of different mechanisms to keep pegs in a way that is under-collateralized, and most of those didn't work. So I think it really comes down to like the mechanisms of the stablecoin, and ultimately, at least from what we've seen in the market, a stablecoin that is not fully collateralized and can be redeemed against some underlying assets is at very high risk of depegging, and it's more a matter of how many people do you need to withdraw in one moment for there to not be enough liquidity to sustain the price, and then bank runs start the same way that bank runs have started for hundreds of years. So it's multifaceted, but if like the design is solid and if there is actual value backing the stable coins and the mechanism to get the stable coins and exchange it for the underlying value, then at least in general it should be pretty pegged.
I think that was a pretty complete, yeah, there are, we've seen lots and lots of different reasons, and I think you highlighted a lot of them. I mean, the one I'd add is poor mechanism design is a common thing. People building stable coins, they need to have humans that are throwing money in to keep interest in it, that it wasn't designed inside the mechanism. You know, that runs for a while. Eventually people realize that they're throwing a lot of money in to pay to keep a token stable. And you can only do that for so long. Like, we hear in TradFi about a lender of last resort. Essentially, in a lot of these tokens, we have, you know, a bag holder of last resort. And that's when we depeg. You know, we need to find an equilibrium, and that needs to be designed in the mechanism. Obviously, when, you know, we have backings, they should be redeemable for something, whether it's a decentralized asset or a non-decentralized asset. And those are pretty good ways, but I guess when those break, that becomes a problem. But just functionally, designing your token in a way that can be sustainable, I think is a prerequisite regardless of all the other questions.
So I know Araya actually predicted the crash of Terra, even when Terra is at its peak. So I think one fun fact about him is like, Do Kwon call you what?
A cockroach.
Yeah. So do you think we have learned from the Terra crash, like the market?
I hope that that there are some lessons that are learned by most people. And I hope that one of them is like kind of being cautious of what we've called like endogenous collateral, something where the value of, where a stablecoin is backed by some other token, but where the value of that token is like circular with the stablecoin itself. So like Terra was backed by Luna, well, sort of backed, but like Luna really only has value because people think Terra has value, and so like there's just like a spiral to zero that's possible there. And if you kind of disentangle the how all of that works, I mean, it's basically equivalent to a Ponzi scheme. And so it shouldn't be too surprising that it just blows up.
Will we have another one this cycle?
Well, that's what I hope we don't.
Well, as a general stablecoin user, I found it. I sometimes do find it very difficult to understand because stablecoin normally wrap, especially the decentralized one, wrap underneath like very complex design. So I come up with a one if statement to help people to try to identify whether that's a Ponzi scheme. Like if the stablecoin is backed, significant part of the stablecoin is backed by an asset created from nothing, created from with no economic value and no other use cases, that is a Ponzi scheme. Is it fair to say that?
I mean, the US dollar would be a Ponzi by that definition.
It has other usage. So apart from the depegging risk, what are the other risks that are often overlooked and stablecoin users may not realize that they too will incur loss?
So like we break down risk into different categories. The big one for us, and also I guess historically where most money was lost in DeFi, is smart contract exploits. So that is all about like, is it possible for someone to use the smart contracts in a way that the developer didn't intend, and through this unintended use take out a lot of the value that is backing the stablecoins that would then lead the stablecoins to depeg. That risk is kind of always there. Like even protocols who have done many, many security audits, who have some of the smartest people behind, they still get exploited. It's just the trade-off that you need to do if you want to be in DeFi and if you want to use protocols that are built on smart contracts and give you all of the trust minimization guarantees and security guarantees. So that's, I think, the biggest one in our view. There's many others. There's things like governance risks, so like who can update the smart contracts that the stablecoin is running on. There are some like considerations around centralization around there. And even if it's not necessarily malicious upgrades of the contracts, you're still relying on the operational security of a small group of people who have access to the smart contract. And we've just seen a couple of weeks ago with the exploit on Radiant that that can happen. Like, it's very sophisticated players doing these attacks, but it can happen that the group of people who has right to upgrade the smart contracts get compromised, and then that leads to the smart contracts being changed in a malicious way and a lot of money being lost. So, and then I guess the other thing is mainly around like economic mechanisms. So many of these stable coins all have different ways to manage the peg, and these mechanisms need to be solid and should have been simulated in different environments and in different market conditions with volatility and other assets being liquidation cascades and things like this. So I think it's really like a multidimensional risk assessment that one needs to do. And the nice thing is that all of the information is there. It's more a question of going through all of the documentation, going through the smart contracts if needed, getting in touch with the team, getting a very deep understanding of what the trust assumptions are, what the security assumptions are, and then coming to a conclusion whether or not that makes sense for the yield that is being offered by the protocols, or if the unique selling points of the stablecoin in terms of network effects and liquidity are worth taking the risks that come with that.
Well, since you just lightly mentioned the governance risk, I would like to go deeper into the government risk. So what are the common types, but maybe for Colin, what are the common types of governance mechanism that have been adopted by most of the stablecoin project nowadays?
Yeah, I mean, I'll kick that off by saying I agree, governance is bad, and stablecoins should have minimal governance whenever possible. I mean, the big risk is things can be changed, parameters can be changed. A lot of people buy into stablecoins because they fit into a product and something they like, and they might find that, you know, they do this and somewhere down the line somebody puts RWAs in the back or puts other things, and it functionally becomes a very different thing than what they expected. Effectively just becomes sometimes a wrapper for a stablecoin, another stablecoin like USDC. You know, that is useful for a lot of people. They like to have whatever, but if you're a long-term holder, and some of these need to be kept long-term because maybe they're backing another immutable smart contract, it's very hard to build your business focused on decentralization if somebody's able to change this downstream. And we find with our users, because we have no governance and we don't have proxies, that's not the main concern people have. It's smart contract risk-based or liquidity-based, in case these guys don't show up. But if you're trying to build something that should be able to stand the test of time, you need to build it on top of components that will remain in a predictable manner. And some of the biggest entities out there, that's what they're concerned with. It's not just ETH maxis that say we love decentralization. It's some of the biggest balance sheets in DeFi do not like governance behind stablecoins. And I think that that's something that's not fully appreciated, because governance is a risk, not just for the average user who goes, oh yeah, my money might get censored. That is a huge risk. You know, USDC can blacklist your address. Some of these stable coins have that as governance, but that's not the only thing that can happen. They can also decide, we're going to completely knock out some of these positions, we're going to add weird things into it, we're going to change it and make it unrecognizable. In some cases, they can, through governance parameters, shut it down and withdraw collateral. They tell us it's for our safety, but what happens if they're asked to do that by a government? Is that still DeFi?
What's your view on that, Araya?
I find it kind of ironic that most people don't care about governance risk when we have a space that has so much like rug pulls in it, which is governance risk, or like one major form of it. I think most of us probably on the stage here agree that like governance minimization is probably a good thing, if not just because it like helps to minimize governance risk, but also like anytime you have like something like a DAO running something is like incredibly inefficient and a bit scary. So where you can minimize that and make it less scary, I think that makes a lot of sense. And that's kind of the approach we also took with Gyroscope. Although I would say we took a more pragmatic approach. We don't think you can actually like remove governance entirely, at least for what we want to build, which is a bit different than what Liquity is building too, so fair enough. But for what we want to build, there are some things you can't really predict how it should change in the future, in particular how like the DeFi space will evolve and how the asset space in DeFi will evolve. And we see that like you basically have to have something that does some sort of governance, at least for what we're building, to be able to adapt to that. But in our view, that is a very that's very good to be a particularly slow process, and we don't need like fast governance to do that, and nor do we want fast governance to do that, because fast governance is a lot riskier than slow governance. If you have slow governance and you're a user of the protocol, you have time to see, is something risky coming up, and am I still happy using this, or do I want to move to something else that isn't doing something this risky? And to the extent that like fast things need to happen in the protocol that we built, we automated it so that should happen automatically by the protocol. We don't have to wait for governance to come in and do a quick action. And instead, governance can specialize in what it should be doing, which is just slow things about how the space should evolve.
Do you think you guys can come up with an example that loss has incurred because the governance process is not optimal in the past?
I mean, yes, as I just mentioned, there was an exploit on a protocol called Radiant, where the full protocol was upgradable by a multi-sig wallet with 3 out of 11 signers required to approve any transactions. And those 3 signers got compromised on their computers, and someone was able to trick them into approving a transaction that they didn't intend. And this malicious transaction ended up introducing a backdoor into the protocol, and around $50 million of liquidity was stolen. So I think this is just like the type of exploits that can happen, and that's the things that we need to protect against, even though we may trust the team, and if it's publicly known people, there's some level of reputation in that. But I think what Daria says is really, really important, where it's about how quickly can bad decisions be implemented. So any changes to a protocol should go through a time lock. They should be publicly visible for some period of time before they go into effect, so that first of all, users can make their own decision whether they are still fine in holding the exposure to the asset after the things change, or even if it is some malicious upgrade, these changes can be blocked before they affect everyone's assets.
Awesome. After the Terra crash, many entities have published their own risk assessment framework, like you have your risk assessment framework within Dialectic. Some of them even go further to public the final risk rating for stablecoin, like S&P or other agency. What is the best practice to assess stablecoin risk? And do you like the idea of having a final risk rating?
Yeah, I think that's a really hard question to answer. People need to spend time in kind of understanding the risks they're taking, unfortunately. That's kind of one of the downsides of being decentralized. I think a lot of people will look at things like USDC as being kind of a flag bearer of what's good, because they trust that there's a big company behind it that has lots of rules, Coinbase and Circle notably. But that is, you know, brings inherent risks inside of it. So if you're looking beyond that, the one we hear a lot when we talk to our users is the lindiness of how long a token's been around and proven itself, how big it is. But that's kind of just an effect, because Terra was very big and was around for a while, so it wouldn't pass on that. Understanding some of the economics and having people that can evaluate that is important. You mentioned kind of the modeling. There are companies out there that are trying to do some of these risk weightings, and I'm a big fan of it personally, because I don't know that everybody has the time or the interest to go through and dig through that. They just say, I want something that is a dollar, and I want it to be a dollar today and a dollar in the future. So giving them tools, I think, is a great thing, and I would challenge the community to come up with more frameworks that we can look at, and hopefully one of those itself will become Lindy, so people can look at it and say, you know, these are some of the frameworks that we like best, and hopefully those don't become corrupted, as we've seen with other ratings agencies.
I thought Araya wanted to add on something.
I definitely think risk frameworks are like a net positive. The one beef I would have is that in terms of like giving one summary stat, it is usually just like a big oversimplification because there's so many different risks, and it really depends on who you are and what you're using the asset for in terms of what the risks mean to you and what the like best solution is actually for you. Depending on what your preferences are, you might prefer USDC. It's extremely liquid. It has a relatively trusted company behind it. It ran into issues, of course. So that's probably shouldn't have happened, but it did. But they got past it. It works fairly well. But for other people, they may like Liquity, for instance. But Liquity also has its own risks, one of them being it's much more price volatile and inherently not as liquid too, because you have to price over such a wider region. But it's like is better when it comes to other risk factors, like using purely decentralized collateral. And there's more than just this too. There's like many, many different reasons you might even prefer other stablecoins than these two. This was part of also the motivation for why we built Gyroscope, because we wanted to make something that was easier for most people to use, or what we think like most users of stablecoins are, that can just handle the risks for you and kind of like balance the various different risks. But still, you might prefer kind of like taking on more of one risk than Gyroscope would take on for you, and less of another. You might not want the balanced approach.
But it sounds like you don't like giving users the information of why they should trust you. They should just do their own research and figure that out. You're against the simplification?
I think having the information out there, definitely net good, or all good. But it feels like there should be maybe something more connected with like what your use case is, I guess, in terms of like helping you figure out what the grade is for different stable coins.
I think I can add on to that as a user, and then I'm coming from a credit risk background. To me, A, B, C, and D has its own meaning, probability of default. But what does A, B, C, and D represent in stable coins term? So that's the confusing part. Quality, trend, how safe it is, it's just unclear. So to me, my best practice will be like the user has to do its homework, right? And then you look at risk in different category, and based on their own risk appetite, they look into the risk rating or risk score for each category, but not have a final risk rating been given. Too handy for everyone. And as I say, it's kind of confusing. I think we have, do you want to add?
Yeah, for some users, the biggest risk is still self-custody. So like even if the stablecoin and everything is very safe, there's like a whole giant group of users for which just the fact that to hold a stablecoin, you need to have your own keys is already like a big risk factor. So I think it really depends on the user, as you said as well. Where like different users are fine with taking different security assumptions, and different users are fine with exposing themselves to different risks. And in the end, everything is risky to some extent, and it's just different types of risks. And it's up to the user to kind of understand them and decide what they feel comfortable with and what not.
Well, we'll have 5 minutes left in the panel. So to wrap up, what's next with you or with your project? And then do you have any advice for any potential stablecoin users here?
So we're launching V2 soon. We know what that means. It will be soon, though. would welcome all of you checking it out, liquidy.org. We'll be releasing a lot more information here extremely soon, including testnets very, very soon. I'm using soon a lot, so just to reinforce this without giving any numbers. But would love if you could check it out. On the yield front, borrowers pay money in, 100% of that's passed back out. It looks closer to a public good than some other things. So we're very excited about it. It is true innovation, and it's truly DeFi. And we feel very strongly on it and would love to hear from you. So hit us up on Twitter, hit us up in our Discord and everywhere else. Hopefully everybody in this room will be a user, plus the people listening online.
For Gyroscope, we've had our main product, the stablecoin, out for coming up on almost a year now, about 11 months. This will be followed pretty soon now by the actual governance token launch. So that's something exciting to look forward to. We're also, I'll be talking actually on Friday about what we think will be the next actual innovation in Gyroscope. What we think will be the next basically 70% improvement on how you can get liquidity cheaper for, in particular, decentralized stablecoins. Why I think it's pretty exciting is that we have USDC and USDT. It has very entrenched liquidity. It's very hard to compete with that. But there are some ways, which I'll be talking about on Friday, that decentralized stablecoins in particular have a unique advantage that just hasn't really been exploited yet. And, well, we want to build the thing that that will exploit it. So come check that out if you're around.
Cool. Yeah. And I mean, on my side, we are mainly liquidity providers. So we get excited whenever these guys build some new primitives that we can play with. And generally, I think that DeFi is ready for another summer moment. So much has been built in the last 2-3 years. So many of the primitives has taken so many steps forward. And so it's just very exciting time for us to be in the market and be working with all of these people and helping them along the way to bootstrap their liquidity and to get a product to more users. On the Dialectic side, we're also starting to think about how we can offer some of our yield strategies to more of a public audience, because right now we're just a private fund. And stay tuned for that.
Well, I think we have 2 minutes. I think we're on time.
You're going to tell us what you're excited about.
Oh, mine. I saw one question actually from the audience talk about what is the best way to measure risk. As I mentioned, I'm working on a risk assessment framework for stablecoin. And then my goal is to identify metrics that can be derived from publicly available data. So it will be a method that combine fundamental analysis and quantitative analysis to try to be as biased, as fair, as unbiased, as fair. And fair as possible. So maybe follow my Twitter account and then I'll have my research paper published, become available soon.
And can I ask one more question as we still have a minute and 36 seconds? This is a question back to the moderator because you don't get to talk enough. As you represent a centralized exchange, do you think that we'll see much more stablecoin listing on centralized exchanges? And if so, why? If not, why not?
Yes or no? Yes, for custodial stablecoin, I think. I'm not representing anyone here, but this is what I understand. We've seen more custodial stablecoin become available in the space, and then they can become regulated or even being used in for payment, especially in Europe. But for decentralized stablecoin, I think it's quite difficult. Though, if you look at the latest regulatory framework by MiCA, I think they will restrict centralized exchange to list decentralized stablecoin. So which means that it will be quite difficult for you to be listed. But at the same time, your regulatory risk should be lower though, because they don't really have a lot of requirement on checking your reserve, for example, or monitoring your issuance or redemption. So it really depends on what you value the most. And do you really need to be listed on centralized exchange though?
We don't necessarily, but some people want that. And
one way is they use decentralized stablecoin on chain, and then if they want to cash out on centralized exchange, right, they can do the swap on DEX. And then from there, you get something else, and then you send the crypto asset to centralized exchange for fiat. Q&A time.
I don't know if you can see this, but they have little billboards that they hold up to say Q&A time.
For the Q&A, either you do the Q&A or I. Up to you.
Oh, okay. This is
down here.
The first one, what's the stablecoin DeSci you are most bullish about right now and why?
Liquidy V2.
Gyroscope.
Liquidy V2 and Gyroscope.
Yes.
Why do protocols with yield-bearing stablecoin also have a governance token?
Because they can raise money with governance tokens and attract people. It's a great bootstrapping mechanism, or it has been, because there is a cost of capital of starting a stablecoin. People will buy volatile tokens because they think the price is going to go up. With a stablecoin, generally people don't expect the price to go up. So you got to give them something, and if you don't have a lot of money raised from a VC, a governance token solves that.
Well, the second one, ballpark odds Tesla gets shut down by US.
It's now, not... after last week, very low, very low.
I mean, it's not even based in US; it's pegged to US dollar, right? Is it like it's a commodity in Cayman Island, or nobody knows Bahama?
Switzerland.
What's the next one?
I mean, there are ways that the government could try to shut it down. I wouldn't say there's no risk, but it does seem like less.
Next one, what do you think of Ethena? Is it sustainable?
I think it's a really interesting idea. I'd say, assuming they do what they claim to do, it is sustainable because they're essentially doing a strategy that is a trading strategy, and they're making that tokenized. So assuming that's all they're doing, and I have no reason to believe that they're doing anything else, that's sustainable as long as people are trading perps.
Yeah, I think it's it makes like economic sense. There's probably two things to think about like sustainable, though, I guess. It has positive rates in some environments and probably negative rates in other environments. And if you have a sustained negative rate environment, in particular when people don't want to take a lot of leverage, which happens during like deep bear markets, you may just have a natural unwinding of the system, at least how it's set up right now, and maybe even disappear.
Anything?
No, I mean, like as all trading strategy, there are some limitations on capacity. So you can't run the same strategy with 10 or 100 times the capital. So like it can't scale forever, but at the size it's now and as the market is right now, it should be good.
Well, the next one will be, why don't protocols use vaults ERC-4626 instead of a stablecoin? Don't they serve the same purpose without the risk of maintaining a stable coin?
I think most people like tokens. That's my short answer.
The humanity.
I mean, if you get a token, something that's just like, oh yeah, I'll be able to put this in and get a dollar's worth out of, let's say, ETH, a dollar in today, a dollar out later, sure, why not? But I think most people like to do stuff with that dollar value, like yield farm or whatever. So that's, I think, generally why users have not been overly interested, but maybe I'm missing something.
Yeah, I mean, I guess to some extent 4626 is also tokenized, but I guess there's just like some composability that comes with just having a token that you can use as collateral, that you can pair with other tokens to provide liquidity in pools. And it's just like the mental model that people have is still very much token focused and not like vault account abstraction focused.
Well, the next question will be, is there a decentralized stable coin that can take over the USDC in DeFi?
Ours. Yeah. I mean, it's. I think it's like we were saying, like tokens will address different things, and a big use case of stable coins is on-ramp and off-ramp. As long as Coinbase is a big way to get in and out, I think USDC and Tether as well will be very important. basically both of those coins extend US dollar banking to unbankable offshore exchanges as well. So you see some of the biggest exchanges, you're not able to trade in dollars, but you can trade against a USDT pair. As long as that is still exist, it's hard to say. If we just restricted to DeFi, I personally would love to see decentralized stablecoins become the main things to do it in. There are tax incentives, at least within Europe, of why that might be better. Maybe that will drive some things, but again, we're Europeans, we're poor, so maybe not.
Another thing is that historically, at least, decentralized stablecoins have suffered like liquidity challenges compared to centralized stablecoins. But I mean, there are actually some ways to turn this around, which is what I'm planning to talk about on Friday, and some advantages that, decentralized stablecoins have some flexibilities that centralized stablecoins don't, that you can actually potentially make them actually much more efficient when it comes to liquidity.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, there's some advantages in having like instant and atomic redemptions in stablecoin, for example, for people doing like arbitrage and doing those sorts of strategies. I think to some extent it comes down to network effects, and USDC, especially in DeFi, has just huge network effects. It's the most liquid asset to swap against ETH and Bitcoin and against many of the other assets. It's the cheapest one to bridge. It's the quickest one to bridge to a centralized exchange. And I feel those network effects are very strong, and there needs to be something that is given by the decentralized versions, like yield bearing, that USDC doesn't have, that is really like a strong use case to win the users over.
I think we should have a healthier competition in the sector, right? Like 94% dominated by four stablecoin is just way too high and doesn't sound very healthy. So as user, that we should just actively explore what are the options there. As like you guys have mentioned, centralized stablecoin and decentralized stablecoin, they offer different sets of benefits. The next one will be, do you think we will ever get a world where there are no stablecoin backed by the USD? Instead, there is single global inflationary currency.
I do hope that we get to see that. I do hope that we get to see stablecoins that are backed by all sorts of assets, because that's just diversification and it reduces the risk on the space and on DeFi in general. I'd love to see more stablecoins be backed by assets that are not USD. About the single global inflationary currency, I think that's what we got with the USD. And we should use ETH as collateral more.
Yeah, I agree. ETH is a pretty good like non-USD backed stablecoin. It's one ETH. Bitcoin as well. Bitcoin is one
money.
Bitcoin.
Yeah, I think the reality is today everybody wants to use like dollars for most things, but that may not always be the case. And DeFi should be ready and prepared to do other things than just dollars at some point too.
100%. This question is to Colin.
Uh-oh.
Will Bold be yield bearing, also immutable like liquidity V1?
Yes.
So then we have room for one more question. Ultimately, are stablecoin yields in the crypto market simply a game of musical chairs?
There's kind of two types of yields that you can get on stablecoins. One is what we would call organic yield. So that's anything that's interest that you earn on lending markets because people are actually borrowing your stablecoins. There's things like trading fees if you're deploying stablecoins into a stablecoin pair on a DEX. So those, I think, will always be there. That's just like the cost of the protocols and the cost of liquidity. But what like most of the yield in DeFi is protocol incentives. And I don't know if that is something that will be going on forever, but the same way that Web2 companies have huge user acquisition costs, I think liquidity incentives are like a very similar parallel for DeFi, where any new protocol needs to solve the chicken and egg problem. And just paying yield and governance token is a great mechanism to do that.
To add a little more to that, there we have some liquidity pools that that from organic yields earn like 10 to 15%. So they do exist, But yeah, a lot of DeFi yields end up also coming from like token incentives. There's many different flavors, I guess.
You guys said everything, so I'm going to skip to the last question. That's what we build, is immutable contracts. It's frontier, but everybody should do it that way.
Well, the music is up, so I think we've got to go. Thank you very much for joining the panel.
Yeah, thank you so much, Alessandro, Aria, Colin, and Tommy, for this very insightful panel. I learned a lot.